Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Good to have you all with us here today. I want to remind you the support for WEAA is provided by AAA Mid-Atlantic. More information at AAA.com/discounts. And before we jump into our conversation today, let's just take a brief look at this day in history. This is a day where some interesting things happened. The one that hits me the most and deepest is this is reminder. This is the birthday of Paul Laurence Dunbar, who was born in the middle of Reconstruction, June 27th in Dayton, Ohio, in 1872. And to start our day, I thought I'd share just one very short poem by Paul Laurence Dunbar, one of America's greatest poets, who was critiqued a lot. Later on, we'll be sharing one of his poems that he wrote about Frederick Douglass, because as we're about to lose Nelson Mandela, it makes me think about what the world in America was thinking when Frederick Douglass left this earth, and how deeply important he was to so many people, and what he meant in his time when he was alive, very similar to what people thought about Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Nelson Mandela and others. But we're about to lose Nelson, and we'll have someone read that poem later on, perhaps on our program when we honor Nelson Mandela. But let me just read this Paul Laurence Dunbar poem before we start our conversation today. It's called We Wear the Mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. The debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile, and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all of our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but O great Christ, our cries to free from tortured souls arise. We sing, but O the clay is vile beneath our feet and the long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask. Paul Laurence Dunbar. Many high schools named after him, and we should be reading his poetry and remembering who he is. Also on this day in our history, this was when the police raid in Stonewall, the gay bar in Greenwich Village, 1,000 people riding against the police, lasted 3 days. As many people say, the beginning of the gay rights movement. It kind of interesting that was today, given the Supreme Court decisions that came down yesterday, which we'll be talking about in the course of this hour. This is also the day that you remember when Mr. Byrd, James Byrd, was brutally murdered in Jasper, Texas. This was the day that the Ku Klux Klan decided to answer that by the march through Jasper. We'll leave that as today in history and get into our conversation. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled on both DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and on the constitutionality of Proposition 8, which allowed gay marriage in California. A lot of questions were raised yesterday when we did our short piece on this, on these decisions yesterday on our program, and there was a lot of lack of clarity. People were still trying to figure out what this meant. Did it really mean that everybody who was married and gay or lesbian would have federal rights or not? What does it mean that Proposition 8 was now upheld in California? And we're going to wrestle with all that this hour. We have David Rocha with us. David Rocha in the studio. He's ACLU of Maryland's senior staff attorney. Good to have you back again, David, always.
Thanks for having me here.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us. She's politics reporter for the Huffington Post. Sabrina, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Alan Van Capel is with us. He is CEO of Bend the Arc, a social justice organization that has organized for marriage equality. And Alan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
So this, in terms of the law here, I mean, there's a lot of confusion. As I was reading the papers this morning, it seems that when they said that DOMA was discriminatory, Defense of Marriage Act was discriminatory, that it's not so clear. It made me think of, even though I'm not equating it to what happened when Lincoln freed the Emancipation Proclamation, which only freed slaves in some of the states, not all the states, we have to remember, this particular act may affect only a smaller number of people who are gay and married. If you get married in Maryland and move to Virginia, it could be different.
Well, it's true that for folks who don't live in one of the 13 now marriage equality states, the situation will be a little bit more complicated. But I think what the Supreme Court opinion is saying is that the era of federal discrimination against lesbian and gay families is over. And the federal government has the power to treat the place of the location of the marriage as the controlling factor for federal benefits. And so if someone was married in Maryland but lives in a state that doesn't recognize the marriage, that wouldn't preclude the federal government from recognizing the valid marriage.
Well, one of the things that the New York Times was emphasizing in their articles, Sabrina, when I was reading the articles today, they actually took the other tack, saying that the federal government often looks at how the state defines marriage, you were married legally in that state, whether or not you could get benefits. So this could be a lot of wrinkles in this.
I think it has been complicated for some to understand, as you mentioned. I think the biggest confusion that I've heard from individuals is, what about states where marriage has actually been banned or you can even say prohibited through either a ballot vote or a state-based amendment? There are, of course, many, many states that bar people, same-sex couples, from being able to get married, and that hasn't changed. So, what people need to understand is this doesn't legalize marriage at a federal level. That's certainly one big issue. You kind of compared it to the Emancipation Amendment under Lincoln, and I think that's probably where the best comparison comes in, that it's certainly still an uphill battle for same-sex couples, but this is a tremendous victory. So, as was just said, from the perspective of federal benefits, they do look at how a state would define marriage, but that was precisely the issue with respect to the Fifth Amendment and making this decision. The Fifth Amendment of the Constitution protects Americans from what is considered, the abuse of government authority in any kind of legal procedure, and that includes preventing or depriving individuals from life, liberty, or property without any due process of law. You cannot withhold private property without just compensation. That was what was at the core of this particular case, where the IRS refused to give over $300,000 back to Edith Windsor after the death of her spouse. So I think that it's still a tremendous victory. It shouldn't be equated with a federal legalization of by any means the same-sex marriage. They've still left it up to the states to define marriage, and that's where we'll have to see how it works out for a lot of couples who, of course, do not live within a state, same-sex couples, that basically allows them to marry, such as those states that have recently legalized same-sex marriage, like Maryland and Iowa and the other, there are 13 in total.
And Alan, the significance of this for you in terms of what we've been talking about?
No, I'd say I woke up this morning and it was the first time I felt free.
Uh-huh.
It is a incredible thing to have the same rights and responsibilities that my twin sister has, because she was born straight and I was born gay. My partner and I are raising on the Lower East Side of New York a 19-month-old son. And what struck me about the decision was what Kennedy wrote. He wrote that DOMA humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples. The law in question even makes more difficult for the children to understand the integrity and closeness of their own family and its concord with other families in their community and in their daily lives. And that is something we live with and feel every single day. So, in a movement that has had many setbacks over the last decade, we've also seen rapid change. Victories are rare, so it's really important to take a deep breath and be excited about what happened, and then also about being realistic about the work that lies ahead. But this was a dramatic shift in the movement for LGBT equality yesterday. And, these questions will get sorted out. But for many people, we hope that the Obama White House and the federal government moves as quickly as possible to begin implementing as many of these rights and responsibilities and getting them to gay families as they can. And I was on a call yesterday with President Obama as he was on Air Force One flying to Africa for his trip. And the president assured us and had the chief counsel to the White House on the phone that they are working, as of last night, to begin implementing it. So there's a lot of work to be done, but certainly it feels good to be free this morning. And I don't think if you've I didn't realize the distinction until I woke up this morning.
Mm-hmm. Now that's I'm hearing it from your perspective, Ellen, I think is really important and powerful. I mean, the notion of feeling free for the first time, and what this allows people to do in terms of they live their lives. And there have been some people I've seen and read about who said that marriage is not the real issue, but you know, people who want to be married in the United States of America, most people in America want to be married. Not all, but most. And I think that this is the notion of this being a liberation and how this affects especially gay and lesbian couples who live in those 13 states is huge.
Absolutely. Look, yeah, gay and lesbian couples wake up every single day. We go to work. We raise children. We pay our taxes. In Edie's case, well more than she should be paying. And we have hope that the system works and that it changes over time. And for us, this has been a long time coming. For me, I'm impatient. I would have liked this to have happened 10 years beforehand.
Right.
But I'm always reminded that the arc of history is long and it does bend towards justice. I run an organization called Bend the Arc, the largest Jewish social justice organization in the country. But it doesn't bend by itself. It bends because people like Edie Windsor make it bend towards justice. And I was really happy and delighted that in my lifetime I got to know Edie and Thea and see them together. And I can't think of another person who has earned her place among civil rights heroes like Edie Windsor.
So, and again, let's talk about what this means for those who, let's say, could be married in New York or Minnesota or Vermont or Maryland or any number of states that the 13 states, that's interesting. I was thinking about the 13 colonies, not the 13 states that allow gay and lesbian marriage. But if you move from Maryland to Wyoming, and where there is no recognized gay marriage for gay and lesbian people, I mean, where does that come in? I mean, some of the things some of these articles are saying that these benefits could vary by agency. Depends on what the rules of the agency are. How the IRS looks at marriage may be different than how the Social Security Administration looks at marriage, and what benefits people get and don't get. I mean, isn't this in some ways, David Rocha, where the battles will happen next?
Those will be part of the battles that will happen next, and of course, part of the battles that will happen will be at the state-by-state level to achieve a full recognition of marriage in all 50 states. And that's a battle that the ACLU, which litigated the Windsor case, is committed to, and in fact is committing $10 million between now and 2016 to do that work at the state level. At the federal level, it's true that some federal programs by statute look at the status of the marriage in the state where the person is domiciled, but that's true of only a very limited number of programs. In others, the rules may vary, but they're not controlled by statute, and the president has the power to set a single rule of recognition for all federal programs, and that rule we think could and should be the simplest rule, which is the place of the marriage is what controls. So if the marriage was valid where it was entered into, that should be the controlling status of whether or not the couple is married, regardless of where they are domiciled.
But that clearly will be a legal battle.
Because
you can see people in certain states saying, no, that's not the case.
Well, but let's just to be clear, this won't be a state decision. There is a battle to be fought at the state level, both about whether the states will grant same-sex marriages and whether states will recognize out-of-state marriages. In the 30 states that have passed specific statutes or constitutional amendments that prohibit recognition of out-of-state valid marriages, out-of-state same-sex marriages, then that issue will have to be either litigated or changed in the legislature. In the remaining seven states where there isn't a specific statutory prohibition, then there's opportunity for those state courts to recognize the out-of-state marriages, just as Maryland did here before we passed the marriage equality law. But all of that is completely separate from federal recognition of marriage, which is controlled by federal statute and federal executive orders, independent of what the states may say.
So 410-319-8888, your thoughts on yesterday's Supreme Court decision. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. Jump on Facebook, our Facebook pages, or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And Sabrina, one of the things that we didn't talk much about Prop 8. And how do you think the decision on Proposition 8 in California said it was not unconstitutional? No, it was unconstitutional to challenge the vote in California.
Right. Well,
what will that mean?
Well, essentially what it's done is cleared the way now for same-sex marriage in California. And what was expected to happen is precisely what the outcome was, and that the defendants who were fighting to uphold Proposition 8 did not have the legal standing to litigate the case. And this came down to what the majority described as judicial versus political. And I think that was a very key moment when Justice Roberts was delivering the majority opinion, which is a lot of the conversation around same-sex marriage is, in fact, political. And to bring a case before the Supreme Court, the argument was there has to be a dispute for the court to settle that has judicial implications. And in this case, what happened was the defendants, the organizers of the ballot, where voters determined not to allow same-sex couples the right to marry, the organizers of that ballot had no real stake in the outcome of this case or of the decision. There was no real harm to them other than their ideological commitment to marriage as being defined between a man and a woman. So, you know, of course, what they've done is clear the way for same-sex couples in California, as mentioned, to marry. And certainly you already heard California's Attorney General Kamala Harris and other officials in California call on clerks to start issuing licenses to those to some of the couples who I think have been requesting and waiting ever since the decision was lying in the balance. And I think that what the biggest part, though, for me was that stood out was that distinction between what's political, because a lot of the, you know, we've talked about how we have to now visit it state by state, and that does set a precedent, that line of reasoning in how states are defining marriage, whether they're defining it as what we call traditional marriage or whether it's the broader, you know, allowing everyone the right to marry, there is now this movement toward recognizing what people's motives are when they oppose same-sex marriage. And it's just literally an ideological commitment or something that's seen as political, and as was seen even the decision of Congress and the Clinton administration with Defense of Marriage Act 2, there was a similar reasoning there with what their motives were. Mm-hmm. That's a big shift in thinking that I think will be reflective of how other states make determinations on the definition of marriage. It certainly sets the tone that simply because you have an ideological commitment against same-sex marriage, you're free to pursue that. That's what Justice Roberts said. The organizers of the ballot who were fighting to uphold Prop 8 are free to pursue that in their lives. No one is forcing them in their personal lives to recognize same-sex marriage. But the point is, you have to have a real stake. You have to prove that same-sex couples, that allowing them the right to marry will harm you, that it's inflicting harm upon you. And that's what opponents of same-sex marriage haven't been able to prove. That's actually what one of the proponents say is, even if you don't recognize marriage equality, why does it matter to you? Why would you bar people the right to get married? So what I think was the biggest takeaway from that case.
I think that's a very critical thing to have pointed out. And we only have like a few minutes left, so I'd like to get some closing thoughts as well from Alan and David on what this means and what comes next. Alan?
Look, you know, yesterday's decision was part of the American tradition of expanding personal rights. What I am really pleased about is that if this conversation was taking place 8 years ago, if we were talking about marriage equality, you would have thought people of faith were automatically opposed to the issue of same-sex marriage. Well, one of the biggest shifts that we saw in this debate was an overwhelming amount of people of faith supporting the rights of same-sex couples to marry. The religious brief filed in the court case, Robbie Kaplan, who argued on behalf of Edie Windsor, said she believes, next to the one, of course, that she wrote, was probably the most important brief that was filed in the court. And I think it is not just a shift in where Americans' attitudes are, but also our faith institutions are solidly behind this issue. And I think that, for me, as a person of faith, as someone who leads a Jewish organization, where, by the way, 81% of Jews support the issue of marriage equality more so than any other constituency, sans gay and lesbian couples, you know, that is a big deal in this country. And so there are lots of things to think about, because there are a lot of movement that happened in this particular moment.
So,
but one of the things that shouldn't be lost is all of the organizing that has taken place over the last decade, particularly with people of faith. And if you're progressive in this country, more often than not, we ignore people of faith on the issues we care most about,
right,
because we don't know how to talk to them. This was a tactical shift on behalf of the LGBT community. They made a particular effort to reach out and talk and use the faith language when speaking to communities of faith, and it paid off dividends this Supreme Court case.
I'm sorry, we only have a minute left. I'm going to let David have a final thought as well. David Rocha.
I think the significance of the case can't be overstated. It's the first Supreme Court opinion that I read with tears in my eyes. I think it's true that change is now, the pace of change is picking up. And in addition to the outreach to faith groups, which I agree has been critical, the ACLU's efforts over the next few years to achieve full equality around the country are focused also on specifically on Republicans, where hearts and minds are also changing rapidly. And the ACLU has hired two key Republican strategists to work on this issue in particular around the country. To help us move the ball in states, in the remaining 37 states around the country. So we're in an incredible place now. The momentum is incredible, and yesterday's decision was historic.
So tears of joy from yesterday's decision,
yep.
Tears of grief from the day before.
That's true.
David Rocha, ACLU of Maryland Senior Staff Attorney, Sabrina Siddiqui, politics reporter for the Huffington Post, has been covering this issue for quite a time. Alan Van Capel, CEO of Bend the Arc, a Jewish social justice organization that is organized for marriage equality. Thank all three of you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be taking a brief break and coming back. Speaking of gender, we're going to talk to some people who in the city who are bending notions of gender, race, and class in their new production of Romeo and Juliet. Stay with us.